need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk. Now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com, and joining me on the other line, OC is lovely this time of year. It's Andy Greenwald!
You know,
it's a Thursday in America. I'm feeling pretty good though, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like, I don't know, I love seeing your face. Today on the show, we've got Jason Concepcion and Shea Serrano. They're going to come and do Gangs of London, which is a new show on AMC Plus with me and Andy. Andy and I are also going to talk a little Marvel stuff, a little Third Day, maybe a little Fargo. But before we do all that, let's take a quick break.
This episode is brought to you by Jiffy Lube. Cars can be a big investment, so it's important to take care of them. I once got a car that I started out with 25,000 miles on. I got it to over 200,000 miles because I took care of it. You know how you take care of a car? You take care of the maintenance, the oil, the brakes, all that stuff. And if you don't, you can have a car just completely fall apart. When your car needs maintenance, head to Jiffy Lube. They provide automotive excellence at speed. Get your oil changed, brakes checked, tons of other multi-care services. It's all done by expertly trained technicians who actually care about taking care of you and your car. Jiffy Lube, car more. To find coupons and start an instant online estimate, visit JiffyLube.com. This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on cars.com.
All right, we're back. Greenwald, now tell me how you were feeling. Let it out.
Oh, you know, I think letting it out would be bad. I think it's good to keep it in sometimes, don't you? I mean,
No, that's not true. This is the conversation. We're here to like kind of just work through all of it. And I want to work through how you're feeling about certain shows, certain pieces of news. But it's a safe space. Our audience is ready for any of your takes. I think what we've been working out over the last couple of weeks, as things have just gotten more and more tense in the world, I think, is like, how do you interface with culture when everything is falling apart around you, when it feels like everything is falling apart around you? How do you find joy in the things that you typically go to for entertainment or intellectual stimulation or emotional rewards when you feel like shit? And I think it's totally fair to be like, these shows are not hitting the way that they may have been intended to.
Yeah, and I think that there are times, and for people listening, I don't think we're going to do this whole conversation again. As Chris said, we're going to talk about specific shows and things. But one thing that I have noticed in my media consumption over the last few days, both for this podcast and for personal reasons, I'm noticing the gears a little bit more, the machinery a little bit more, which is to say that, you know, one of the things that we often do, and I think it's one of the good, it's part of our good work that we do here, we try to do, right, is we want to be cheerleaders for the medium, and the medium is generally television, and I want television to take chances, and I want people to stretch their wings and fly. But what I am really craving, I think, partly, as you said, due to the what feels often like societal collapse happening, but literally there's a societal collapse in that we can't really gather as a society at the moment, is I am looking for a kind of acknowledged or shared humanity in the character work of the stuff that I'm watching, which, yes, everyone who listens knows that if there was a 2.5-hour French movie about liberal elites talking about e-publishing, like the movie Nonfiction I talked about a few weeks ago, yeah, I'm the guy for that. But at the same time, they were just people in their lives, and there was style and there was art to it, but there were people in their lives, and I enjoyed feeling that sense of, you know, being a part of actual life out there. And I say this all as preamble to why I have been, I think, specifically struggling with the slate of shows that are in front of us right now, and to name them Third Day, Utopia, The Boys, even in its most recent episode. Obviously, we'll talk about the finale next week. And even Gangs of London, not to step on the conversation we're going to have with Shay and Jason.
You were a good sport about Gangs of London, though. That's not your bag.
No, but it's super fun to hang out with those guys and to watch something completely different and to appreciate. I mean, I can appreciate beautiful direction and action. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not made of stone here. But even a show like that, which is doing something very specific and it's doing it well, or Fargo, which is, you know, Fargo at its heart has always been doing a bit, right? I think I want less bits. And to bring it all the way back to Third Day, which is a show that I have no sense of how many of our, what percentage of our listeners are watching it. So we can, but I think to fold it into the larger conversation that everyone can be a part of. So everyone knows, first three episodes, dazzling. Jude Law is like, you know, like Midsommar or Wicker Man, two movies I've never seen.
Though I would say those first three episodes started at the first episode about as excited as we have been about a show in 2020. And then sort of slipped a little bit each successive episode.
Yeah, and then, but as made clear by the fact that this weekend there was a 12-hour live stream that included Jude Law digging a hole for an hour and then taking a nap for 10 minutes, this show is not trying to scratch your prestige TV itch. It mm-hmm. is blazing a pretty wild and innovative trail in the immersive theater community. That's what it's doing, and I respect the hell out of it. That said, part of its structure, which is, I can't tell if it's commenting on, playing into, trying to play against the sort of cyclical nature of episodic television. First three episodes are the first 3 days with Jude Law's journey to the island. Then there's this theatrical break. And then the fourth episode, which aired this week, is a different season. It's winter now. Mm-hmm. And presumably after the events of Jude Law's visit and Naomi
and
Harris,
after the events of the theatrical experience, which I admittedly only watched like bits and pieces of.
You didn't watch all 12 hours?
Well, no, but I also was like, I think that once it was pretty clear that whatever happened in the 12-hour play, you weren't going to need that to enjoy the rest of the season.
No, you could just enjoy it or experience it or what have you. Naomi Harris, who an actress who I love, I have a lot of time for. People probably know her best from the James Bond movies, I think.
Black Mirror.
Anyway,
you know, yeah, she's
in Black Mirror. She is now driving not a Subaru this time, but a Volvo.
Yeah.
The difference that I noticed.
Larger car than you usually see in England. Very, very, they're very partial to smaller vehicles there.
With her two daughters, she decides to rent a rustic Airbnb over the causeway in OC. And I have to say, you know, I'm nothing. I'm honest with you guys, right? This is my safe space. I tapped out. And I'm not proud of that. And maybe I'll go back, but I watched the first 30 minutes of this hour-long episode, and it was essentially a replay of the first arrival that Jude Law did, only this time with added racism and little children. Mm. And I didn't have it in me. You know, the number of times people do something they obviously shouldn't do in order to get to the story that they want to tell. It's like, fool me once, shame on me, but fool me twice.
So
in
did
the
you
same
read
show.
About? Did you read like a recap for the rest of the episode?
No, and maybe, you know, I just kind of wanted to bring you the uncut raw that
That's
I basically
fine.
Couldn't do it.
So there's couple things going on here. For one, you know, people doing things. I watched this with my wife Phoebe, and she was just like the entire time being like, get off the island. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
So at the end of the episode, you find out that Naomi Harris has arrived on this island and that Jude Law is her husband, and these are their children. So obviously they are looking for Jude Law's character, who presumably, I don't know whether he has been pronounced dead or whatever in the intervening time between summer, autumn, and winter where we are.
Right.
But she has got some reason for being there. She is on a quest, not just on an absolutely doomed vacation.
Okay, so she knows.
Yeah. Everything
she went there on purpose.
She went there on purpose. This is not like accidentally I got an Airbnb in the worst place in the world.
Okay, can I just say?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll watch episode 5.
Okay, cool.
That's all it takes. But I wish that, I think part of the performance of being a TV critic and then a professional podcast host would be to push down my reaction.
And get through the next 30, yeah.
And get through it and learn before. But I had to bring you the truth. But that's interesting to me. But even the exercise of making us go through that.
Right. Well, I want to say
excessive.
Something about this.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. This show, for as avant-garde as it can be, for as psychedelic as it can be, for as much as it is about, maybe it's allegorical about environmentalism, I think you see some shades of that. And there's a real like sort of a historical quality to the narrative. I think I mentioned last week that it felt like a lot of this stuff that happened in episode 3 mirrored some Arthurian legend about the connection between a leader and the health of an ecosystem. This is basically a horror movie. And the best part of horror movies for me are the setup. And it was pretty refreshing once, and I want to address the sort of element about the kids. It was pretty cool to get some different characters interacting like normal people in the show. So the reason why I thought the first episode or two of Third Day were so great was because you were taking these people and thrusting them together. And I felt like the Catherine Waterston character and the Jude Law character were these people who had kind of arrived at this island at different points in their life, weren't quite being completely honest about who they were. There was this facade that this was like a vacation paradise, or that this was like a community that had sort of figured out how to run a society in this equitable way. Obviously, the place that Naomi Harris arrives is not that. It's basically a desiccated, you know, corpse of a place, and is, you know, tarps everywhere, pissing rain, looks cold. There's no reason why she should be there other than this quest.
Yeah.
The problem that they have created for themselves is that this show now has a Baby Yoda problem, because these kids are too fucking cute.
I know.
Like, these kids are not like... They should have cast like Damien from The Omen or something, because then I would have been like, it doesn't really matter.
These kids are stunning. They're amazing.
They are 99.9 percentile of the cutest kids I've ever seen in my life. And I don't have children. So I am already like, this will either be a lot of harrowing children in danger, but you know that they're not going to do anything to them, or something bad is going to happen to these kids, and I'm just going to be like, why am I doing this to myself? So I do see where you're coming from on that part.
I appreciate everything you're saying, because I definitely buried that lead, just like Jude Law buried whatever pieces of crockery or his past, as he did during the 12-hour theater thing, which is that as the father and husband of a family that has a wife and two daughters driving into peril and then being like, these kids need to go to the bathroom and get some food in them. Like, Nope. I mean, I've been on this island now for 3 hours.
Yeah.
3 days. It's a tough one. It's a tough one. But to bring it full circle, I think that often, whether due to space we had in our personal lives, or time that we just had, or artistic creativity or artistic curiosity that we've had, I think that we've had a pretty healthy appetite for shows that we just love, you know, whether they're high-minded fare or, you know, Parks and Recreation or something, or in your case, Ted Lasso, and shows that we admire. There's a big category of shows, you know, that, I mean, I think I truly love The Young Pope, but at the same time, I mean, those episodes...
That's a perfect example, though.
Those episodes were long AF.
And there's a show that I admire, but I did not like.
I do think that my appetite for just admiring something is at a low at this moment.
So since we're sharing, and I don't mean to talk about something that you haven't gotten a chance to check out yet, but I just wanted to mention that it does feel like the volume of shows that we're moving through right now is very high. Like, you and I usually tend to settle on one or two things, and then we talk about them for about 6 or 7 weeks on and off. Right now, I think we're juggling like 3 or 4 or 5 different shows. I watched the third episode of Fargo, which... definitely think that it corrected certain things. Like, the first episode of Fargo definitely spends just way too much time setting up American history before it gets to just like even the first lines of dialogue uttered by a character of consequence. I think that one of the things that jumped out at me about this third episode of Fargo, and I just want to toss this to you as like a general TV consumer and maker, is there are several really cool, good, interesting shows inside of this season. There is the crime family war. There's the Jason Schwartzman, Chris Rock sort of clash, and the internecine fighting going on in those families. And you could have the son swapping there, which I wouldn't be surprised if is based on some sort of historical research, but is the kind of thing that's like a little too cute by half for something like this. Then there is this Ethel Rita funeral parlor family in Kansas in 1950, interracial family in Kansas in 1950, and they're the fugitives living with them, the mother's sister. That's pretty interesting. Then there is like another show that Jesse Buckley is in. And I don't know. I know that Noah is good enough to bring all this stuff together, but I kind of just wish sometimes that shows weren't so special and weren't so weighted down with the necessity of, boy, if we're going to do this, we got to do all of it, because there it's just dragging too much narrative weight behind it. And that every time I feel like Fargo takes off for 5 or 6 minutes and it feels like, ooh, Glenn Thurman is just fucking cooking right now. And then it's like, no, but we got to go do these 6 other plot lines. And it's like, the Ben Whishaw show is amazing. The Glenn Thurman, Chris Rock show is cool. Like, there are a bunch of shows in this show that I'm really interested in. But bringing them all together as this ensemble, I don't know, man. It's like, it's not Altman,
I love the point you're making, because I think it's crucial to our understanding of the second decade of the great century of American television that we're in.
Yeah.
Because for, you know, not to make this another backward-looking thing where we talk about the glories of David Chase and Matt Weiner, but I think it's important to talk about them because they are lauded for many things. Obviously, we're talking about the creators, The Sopranos and Mad Men, who worked together on The Sopranos. You know, they kicked this off. Those are masterpiece shows. And I don't think people are trying. I don't think people are coming for their belts. I don't think people are trying to compete with those shows necessarily anymore. But sometimes I do wonder if the wrong lessons were learned from them. Because one of the things that Chase and Weiner were expert at, and they learned this the hard way by working on Kolchak the Night Stalker in I'll Fly Away, which was a good show, and Becker, as Matt Weiner did, which is the correct ratios for hour-long entertainment. And one of the things that I admire the hell out of in Mad Men more than anything else when I look back on it now. And Mad Men isn't Fargo. It's, you know, it's apples to poisoned apple pie if you're comparing them. It's not the same thing at all. But when I look back at Mad Men, it's an almost, it appears to be effortless juggling of characters and plot lines that feel sublime. At the end of a Mad Men episode, you didn't feel short shrifted in any way from what the episode set out to accomplish. Mm-hmm. And I think that part of, you know, successive generations of anything, there's a little bit of Oedipal, like let's kill dad, let's kill the darlings, let's kill the way we thought things were supposed to be. And to Noah's credit, and in this case, a little bit to his, you know, we're criticizing it. From the beginning, Noah was like, I refuse and I reject the rules of television as it's been understood. The reason that he told me that he hired me 5 years ago was I didn't have the same brain as people who have been working in writer's rooms.
Right.
That's a very high-minded and kind way of saying I didn't know how to structure stuff. You know, that's not what he was looking for, and he figured he could work around it. And he obviously,
but he was looking for somebody who might say, "What if we did it a different way?"
Or what if we just did all of it? Mm-hmm. Because why not? Because we can now. We are empowered. This isn't David Chase like still feeling sorry on some level for making television when all he wanted to make was cinema, right? And so, the flip side of that, the downside of that, at the time, kind of radical auteurism, is then you have shows that just do everything.
Yeah.
And if you do everything, you kind of do nothing. And I just to end the monologue by saying, you know, when I was making Briar Patch, there was a storyline that was passionate, that I was passionate about, not from the book, that brought in a Border Patrol character and a sort of a feint towards an illegal immigration storyline. And I got really excited about that chance to tell a story in this field. Did research, brought in a brilliant consultant named Francisco Cantu, who wrote a great book, highly recommend it, called The Line Becomes the River, about the border. And I think that, and a great actor named David Zaldivar, who played the part of Lalo. And I think we did our best. And I think the storyline worked within the episodes we made. But one of the lessons I learned was if you want to build a successful boat, you can't put everything on it.
Yeah.
There's just not room for everything. And so ultimately, do I think that storyline worked on my show? I think maybe, but I also think we gave it short shrift. And something that important, I wish we had given it full shrift, you know?
Yeah.
So I bring that up not to do mea culpas, but to say like, I completely get the desire to be like, if you can do it, do it. We're not promised anything in this world and they're giving me a budget and I can make a show. But the downside is, as you pointed out, like you're watching a show that has 10 shows and you're only invested in 6 or 7.
And I will
of them.
Say in shows, most seasons of Fargo, I think the Allison Tolman season is season 2, correct?
That's season 1.
Season 1. I mean, I would say the first two seasons of Fargo, which I adored, were slow starters for me. So that's why I'm sticking with this season of Fargo, because I want to see it. the difference here, and it goes back to your Mad Men point, I remember when Mad Men came out, I didn't know who any of those people were. Mm-hmm. You know, I think I'd seen Slattery around and I'd seen some of those actors as character actors in other shows maybe, but I didn't know who Ham was and I didn't know who Elizabeth Moss was and I didn't know who January Jones was. When you're watching Fargo this season, and there's a scene in the third episode where Timothy Oliphant, who's playing it's one of my favorite actors, who's playing a U.S. Marshal, which is like, sure, just keep doing it. You're really good at it. He plays a Mormon preacher who is also a U.S. Marshal, who's very against blasphemy and is talking a lot about, you know, the Mormon faith. And he has come to town to look for the sister of Ethel Reed's mother and as a fugitive. He's paired up with the Jack Houston character. The Jack Houston character is in the pocket of the Italian mob and has extreme OCD. So there's a scene where the two of them are in this car together waiting outside of the funeral home and two really good actors. And I can't believe the car didn't go through the pavement with the amount of bits that were going on. Like, Oliphant's eating carrots. Houston's blinking 100 times a second. You know, everybody is just doing the most that they can with this scene that is literally just two guys sitting in a car talking outside of a funeral home. And it's that cramming in. And I can't help but wonder if it's satisfying these like very big names doing very small parts, probably. And you're getting in essentially like movie stars or television stars, huge actors to play these roles. And I'm like, are you writing to the size of the role? Because there's no quiet, loud, quiet in this show. Everybody is doing a thing. And we've talked about that. I am going to stick with it because Fargo has paid off in the past. So I want to see it, but I just thought I would mention it. I hope we don't sound too negative.
No, I think it's interesting. And it's something that I think about a lot separate and apart from this show, because the best advice that I got on the creative level from two very different showrunners, from Noah and from Sam Esmail, was basically go for it. Mm-hmm. Go big, take the chance, because you know you have the opportunity to make something, and so you shouldn't waste any plays, basically. And you know, I think they're Noah has become one, and Sam has always been a director, so I think they also are thinking visually.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think it's just good advice when you're writing a script and you're like, well, what? There are only so many scripts in an hour. I mean, only so many scenes in a script, and so why should this just be people talking just to move from A to B to C? You know, you want to take advantage of every rep. I think the danger of that, particularly as shows become more concentrated, more condensed, more limited, is the ratio.
Yeah.
Because doing big, broad character work and making every scene snap, crackle, and pop in a two-hour movie, sure. In a 10-hour, what is essentially, you know, high-minded auteurs would call it a 10-hour movie, that's a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
To be fair, it's not Grey's Anatomy where you don't have 16 seasons to kind of, you can mail in a couple plays, you know what I mean? And just. But sometimes TV just needs to be the connective tissue, and figuring out when you're just sinew and when you're actually bone to try to come up with a weird anatomical metaphor on the fly, I think that can be tricky. And I think even the greats get tripped up.
I want to get to our conversation with Jason and Shay about Gangs of London.
But I have one thing
I have one thing I want to talk about too.
Is it the same thing?
I want to talk about the fucking multiverse. Let's say it
at the same time. One, two, three.
Multiverse. Yes!
It is the same thing.
What the fuck is the multiverse? And will you tell me why I'm saying that?
If you guys are still listening, we're going to talk about the multiverse in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but then I'm going to drop, however many minutes into this podcast, the hottest Spider-Man take you are going to hear this year. Okay? I'm just letting you know. So don't fast forward to Shay and Jason yet, because even though they're probably the best things about this whole podcast. The multiverse is a concept that we've seen in other science fiction stories and other comic book stories, but is essential to the Marvel Universe in print, where it's just the simple idea that we are not in a universe, we're in a multiverse, and there are many, many different dimensions where there are different versions of Earth, different versions of Spider-Man, different versions of all our heroes, et cetera, et cetera. And certain characters,
Kai,
some of their
like,
best work.
If only that were true.
Comes out, I know, where she's working on the Bakari Sellers show instead of this one. But here we are. the Ant-Man stuff, I think, started to get, they got into the quantum realm, so it was getting pretty comic booky. But then super geeks got really excited when the Doctor Strange sequel title was announced, which is like Doctor Strange in the multiverse of madness. Horrors or mystery madness. Or something.
Yeah.
Which is extremely like deep cut 60s, 70s LSD Marvel, like from Jack Kirby's illustrations to Jim Starlin's writing. And could be cool. For a Doctor Strange character, that seems cool. I'm into it. What people are getting a little, in my mind, a little overly hyped about is how this multiverse idea, which again, hasn't appeared on the cinema yet, but appears to be creeping into this next generation iteration of Marvel movies. And the big news was that with Spider-Man, the third Sony Marvel Spider-Man movie set to come out next year, although I don't think they filmed it yet, is the Tom Holland series. First, that Jamie Foxx, who played Electro in the second, in the second Andrew Garfield Spider-Man movie, would be reprising his role as Electro in this movie, suggesting, oh, so does the Andrew Garfield Spider-Man exist in the multiverse of Marvel movies? Are they going to suggest that they are all happening at different times and link them in some way? And then it was announced that Benedict Cumberbatch will be playing Doctor Strange in this movie, making people get even more excited about that. And so the I guess the opportunity here is not only that Tobey Maguire could dance again in the Marvel Cinematic Universe wearing a black turtleneck, but also that characters who had died, like maybe Tony Stark, could come back at some point because they lived to a ripe old age, having defeated Thanos without personal harm in a different world, right?
Definitely hope if they're going to do that, it's the former. Like, I mean... Tobey Maguire, if you want to go find him in whatever West Hollywood underground Hold'em game he's been in for the last 5 years, like, go
for it. Do you think he knows there's a pandemic? Do you think he knows?
Do you think he knows that, like, podcasts exist? He's just been grinding out hands like Teddy Kaddish for, like...
can you picture he finally gets an alert on his iPhone 5?
Yeah, and it's like...
He's just like, what the...
Check out Serial. I hope it's the former, where they bring back some Spider-Man stuff. If it would be disappointing,
you don't want that.
It would be disappointing for me if they brought back Downey. And I don't necessarily think, unless the Sherlock Holmes expanded universe goes Jesus incredibly Christ. Poorly for him and his wife who's producing. I just hope that they actually end on the note of Endgame and take the W.
I don't think it's going there, although. Downey will play Tony Stark again. That's going to happen at some point in the next decade or two. But this is not where these movies are necessarily going. They're just that this seems to be an exciting idea for them story-wise or whatever. Great, fine. Mm-hmm. It's also something that was made extremely popular and played super well with the Into the Spider-Verse movie, which Sony didn't, I think, know what it had on its hands. It felt like it was a straight-to-video kind of thing until suddenly they put it in theaters and it became not only a massive moneymaker and smash hit, but it was many people's favorite comic book movie of the last few years. And also, because it was animated, a whole generation of kids have watched multiple times on Netflix. And so this idea of multiverse, that there are many Spider-Men, not a problem, yeah. Not an obstacle.
No,
for the
only
next generation
dorks
of
like you
fans.
And me are like, everything that you should stay dead,
right.
Tony Stark.
But here's the thing that I want to say. There's a creeping feeling that I got from these recent Sony Marvel Spider-Man movies, the Tom Holland movies. Now, we enjoyed them quite a bit, particularly the first one, mainly because they seem to understand that the eternal appeal of Spider-Man is it's a high school thing. So Tom Holland and Zendaya were just great and charming and it was fun and the other kids in the class were well cast. But there was also this second current going through these movies, which I chafed against, which is that Spider-Man is the heir to Iron Man's legacy and that Spider-Man is best when he has a high-tech Stark armor suit and is fighting supervillains in Europe or whatever, which seemed to be completely antithetical to what I just said was the most appealing part about Spider-Man. So they were trying to straddle that line. The fact that in the third outing of this character, they are going to potentially introduce the idea of a multiverse tells me one thing and one thing only, that they really don't know still, eight movies in, how to tell a Spider-Man story in a movie. Which is what leads me to my next comment. The way movies are going, and the way TV is going, Chris, Spider-Man is a TV show. It's not a movie. That's my galaxy brain take.
I agree.
Because
with you.
The thing that is essential about Spider-Man is Peter Parker's life is stressful, whether he is in high school or he's graduated high school and he's hustling as a photographer for the Daily Bugle. It is low level world building with high stakes on the personal side as much as it is on the I have to defeat Rhino and the Sandman side.
Sure.
The way movies are going, the expectations for the Marvel Universe is that every time we get the gang back together for one of these $200 million blockbusters, an entire city, if not the entire galaxy, must be in peril. And Spider-Man doesn't work in those stories unless you use him like the Russo brothers, which is in Endgame and Infinity War, which is to be like, I'm a high school kid. Why am I in a space station?
Sure.
We need that guy, but he's not defeating those things on his level. So
you want him to have week to week adventures.
Yeah. Yeah. Because his life is actually interesting, as opposed to, does anybody care about Captain America's home life? Like, there was a whole plot line in the 80s in the comic books where Captain America gets burned out and disillusioned with the country, so he grabs a motorcycle and just rides around the country on a motorcycle, painting watercolors of what he sees. I mean, I liked it at the time, but that's not a movie, you know what I mean? And it's probably not a good TV show either. Unless it's sort of a Bob Ross like DIY kind of thing.
So the reason why we're kind of what we're basing this all off of is, frankly, a tweet from an account called either Doctor Movie News or DR Movie News. I'm assuming it's Doctor.
It's either he's a medical doctor or he's based in the Dominican Republic. Either way, respect.
And I gotta be honest. I mean, like, all due respect to the doctor. Like, I don't know where he's sourced, but he's saying, guys, it's a given. The multiverse is happening, and quotes. They will all be back calling it now. And then there's a sort of panel of all three Spider-Men. It's obvious that the planned storyline will begin with WandaVision, carry into Spider-Man 3, and conclude with Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness. This is the way. So yeah, I guess that's in play. I personally think that whatever happens now, and you know, we've obviously gone over a bunch of casting announcements and a bunch of the date moves. I just think that, like, the next step for this whole thing is Fantastic Four and X-Men. And while I'm interested in Ant-Man 3 and all this stuff, like, I just thought it was a kind of like, I don't know that the world is ready to kind of to juggle all of this.
And I don't presume to know Kevin Feige's business, but considering how canny he's been about this and how ahead of the game he's been about this, I don't think that his next move is going to be to make it required viewing to watch a Disney Plus series, the third movie in one series and the second movie in another series, just to follow a plot that's main goal is to bring back Andrew Garfield. That is fanboy service. That's not what's gotten him to where he's been. I think the decentralized nature of what he's doing is a very, very smart response to just how big everything got.
Yeah.
And I think it looks even smarter now we're entering into, you know, deep global uncertainty, but particularly financial uncertainty and uncertainty with movie theaters. It looks like a very wise and prescient retreat from you must line up and watch each one of these two to $300 million.
It's maximum
movies.
Flexibility. And it's maximum flexibility because it's like, maybe if something really takes off, we don't restrict ourselves narratively by the idea that this person could still live in another world, in another reality.
And though, because of the multiverse, what we could then do, which is what I think they've secretly wanted to do for a while, is we can keep Tom Holland as this top level, as long as they can afford him and they can make the deals work, as this top level web slinger in whatever iteration the Avengers movies take going forward.
But there are other Spider-Men.
And then we can introduce Miles Morales into Disney Plus on a TV show.
Damn, you're smart.
And get where we want, where they kind of want to be anyway. That's wrapped up in a little bow for you. And you thought I was coming into this podcast unprepared.
No, I knew you were prepared. I knew you were prepared. And you're prepared to talk about Gangs of London with me and Shea Serrano and Jason Concepcion. So just quickly, for people who don't know, and I'll explain this in a second, but this is a new show. It's not a new show globally. It came out in England a little while ago, and now it's over here on our shores. It's through AMC Plus. It's directed by Gareth Evans, who directed the two Raid films and Apostle. And he came on The Watch, actually, to talk to me about Apostle. And it is basically unlike any action television I've ever seen. If you've seen the Raid films, you'll get a crash course in cutting edge stunt work and sort of action set pieces. But this is essentially like a very straightforward crime drama with this kind of kinetic action on top. So Andy and I talked to Jason and Shay about that. A little bit of admin. Next Monday, we're going to be talking about the Boys finale. So that's coming out tonight on Amazon. We'll talk about that on Monday and hopefully have a special guest for that one. So Greenwald, until then, man.
And I just also want to say, though I went into this conversation with our own version of the Boys, Shay and Jason, maybe not as rabid about the show as the rest of you, I loved being a part of the conversation, and my absence from the back half of it had nothing to do
just
with my distaste for neck snapping or anything. I had technical difficulties and came back big at the end. So thanks to those guys. Let's get into our conversation with them.
Before we get to our interview with Jason and Shay, Andy, I just want to say, you know, with Election Day on its way, I wanted to make sure everybody has figured out where they're going to go vote. You can do that by hitting up ballotready.org to find your polling place. And you can vote in many places, in many states, before November 3rd. So this is probably the most consequential election we'll face in our lifetimes. Think about it. Make sure you're registered. Make sure you know where your polling place is. You can go and find out if you can vote early. Check if you can mail in your ballot or vote early in person at ballotready.org. Let's get into our conversation with Jason and Shay.
This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Trello help power global collaboration for all teams so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. Atlassian.com. Atlassian. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. This episode is brought to you by Jiffy Lube. Cars can be a big investment, so it's important to take care of them. I once got a car that I started out with 25,000 miles on. I got it to over 200,000 miles because I took care of it. You know how you take care of a car? You take care of the maintenance, the oil, the brakes, all that stuff. And if you don't, you can have a car just completely fall apart. When your car needs maintenance, head to Jiffy Lube. They provide automotive excellence at speed. Get your oil changed, brakes checked, tons of other multi-care services. It's all done by expertly trained technicians who actually care about taking care of you and your car. Jiffy Lube, car more. To find coupons and start an instant online estimate, visit JiffyLube.com.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details.
Andy and I are now joined by Shay Serrano and Jason Concepcion.
Yes.
You know them from the Connect podcast.
Yes.
You know them from NBA Desktop, Emmy award-winning NBA Desktop. You know them from the New York Times bestseller list. They're also our friends. And that's what's important because friends get to talk about bar fights with friends.
Also, I always say this about them. They're the only two good people on Twitter. And I'm always grateful for that.
That's true. We're here to talk about a show that I think is going to be a challenge. It's a challenge for people because it's very violent. It's called Gangs of London. It is on AMC Plus. That's the other challenge. I think people might have a little bit of a difficulty finding it. Just do this. If you were interested in this conversation, if you haven't already seen Gangs of London, just Google it. You can find AMC Plus's site. It's available on certain cable providers on demand. You can also sign up for it via Apple TV and Amazon. You can watch it that way. This
can
is
I also
important.
Say, if you are not interested in this show at all, but you're interested in the conversation with these three handsome men surrounding me on the Zoom screen, I got you. I am your Sherpa up this mountain.
I appreciate Andy's. Andy, never let it be said that you don't give 100% every pod. Because this guy watched Gangs of London. Now, for me, I'm going to speak for Jason and Shay. Mm-hmm. This show is our Emily in Paris.
Fucking
if you tell me
awesome.
That there are warring crime families in London exacting extreme amounts of vengeance and violence on one another.
Extreme vengeance.
And then you add in an undercover cop who's in too deep.
Are you in so deep?
It's a lot of boxes. It's a lot of our boxes that are getting checked off.
I don't want to derail things, but I do want to go around the horn here. Is there a city in which all those things could be happening?
Let's pick one of the grand capitals of Europe. How about that? Ex-capitals of Europe. Now currently its own thing, thanks to Brexit.
Right.
But let's just put it in London. How about that? Would that be something you are interested in, Jason Concepcion?
Gangs of London, any city. Yes.
Gangs of Albuquerque? I'm fucking in.
I barely survived it.
Pick a city and I'm fine. I'm good. I'm ready to go.
All right. So it's really the first part. It's the gangs part.
So just a little bit more setup. 3 episodes of this show have been released so far. They're on AMC Plus. It comes from the mind of someone very important to me, Jason and Shay, a guy named Gareth Evans. Because you're here to keep us in check. Because
keep going.
You're Sandra Bullock. You're here to keep us tethered to the spaceship in some way. Floated away, right?
I thought you were talking that she was driving the bus. Like, which
you
Sandra Bullock?
You could drive the bus, too. Do it all.
You guys are all Big Mike, and I'm your adopted mom, okay? And I'll tell you what's what with sass. Okay, go on.
Gareth Evans is the director of the 2 Raid films, which are 2 of me and Shay and Jason's favorite movies.
Absolutely.
They changed action filmmaking completely. In some ways,
yes.
And I would argue that Gangs of London is proof of this. My guy broke action movies. He is the lineup of death of death.
Yeah. I would agree with that. There's a level of pace that comes with a Gareth Evans film that is just and chaos that is just extremely hard to replicate. And I think the first episode of Gangs comes close to it in the episode culminating bar fight. But even then, you really realize how, man, that kind of chaotic, everybody fighting in the background, people falling into things, getting their legs broken off the corner of an object, that kind of constant frenetic action is, I don't even know how you diagram that up. How do you put that on screen? And Gangs gets about 97% there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I do really wonder whether or not there were any legal parameters around the filming of the show that maybe were not in place in the Raid, and that's where the 3% comes in.
Yes.
But Shay, it's basically, if people want to know what this is like, it's basically 52 minutes of drama of just guys talking and people trying to figure out what's going to happen.
Who killed my dad.
In the wake of this crime lord's death. And then, at least in the first 2 episodes that I've watched, it culminates at the end with a fight scene unlike anything you will ever see. A bar fight scene unlike anything you will ever see. What are your thoughts on the first 2 episodes, Shay?
Oh, I'm right there. I'm right there with you. I didn't even know that it was Gareth Evans until a little earlier today. And I just so happened to be talking to Sean Finnessy about it. And he mentioned, oh, that's the Raid guy, right? And I said, no, Eco. I thought you were talking about Eco. I was like, Eco's not in this show unless I've watched the wrong one. Oh, no, the director, I went and looked. I'm like, oh, that makes fucking so much sense. To the point that Jason was making, the only difference between the fight scene here and the fight scene in The Raid is that in The Raid, you have Eco, who is the greatest movie fighter that has ever lived. You could just turn the camera on him and he could do stuff that nobody else can do. But just the chaos that they're able to summon out of nowhere, because you don't see it coming at all. Like, I didn't know anything about the show until Chris texted me about, hey, watch this show. This is a cool show. All right, cool. Chris so far has told me in my life, hey, watch The Equalizer, check. Hey, watch John Wick, check. Hey, did you watch The Raid and The Raid 2? And Chris is, in my mind, the best recommender of anything. So he said, watch the show. I was like, cool, I watch it. I start watching it. I'm like, oh, I get it. This is like
how Chris likes Mad Men. This is like gangster Mad Men.
I'm like wire cutter for dudes getting their asses kicked.
Yeah, yeah, I had no idea what was going to happen. And then they all walk into the bar and what's his name? Elliot is the last guy to go in. He's just sort of gathering himself at the end. And you see him take that big breath. And then that's the only hint that he's like about to start doing shit.
Yeah.
Crazy. And then he walks in and it's just fucking madness for the next 8 minutes.
It is
just hardcore. You're like, where did this come from? What is going on? You watch the second episode. They do the same thing. They get up into the one big fight and then just turn the volume up again. And you're like, this is fucking awesome.
So I got two thoughts here. One is, this is a beautiful, beautiful story of friendship and community. Not the show, this podcast. Oh. Because what I'm realizing is that when Chris opens up his cell phone, okay, it's basically like he's sorting the laundry. You've got the socks, you've got the shirts, maybe you've got some, basically the things that go into my window are like, here's a twee pop band from Philadelphia you may have missed. Also, here's some trenchant analysis about the political situation. And then he's like, now where can I put this hyper-violent nugget of London grime? Oh, I got some guys for that. And he just sorts it. So it's kind of beautiful. He keeps it moving.
Yeah.
The second thing I want to say is, maybe you can help me. And by me, I hope I'm speaking for the 1% of listeners who is pretty confused by a lot of this. Is this just like how, you mentioned Gangs of Albuquerque, Shay, the thing that I realized when I was in Albuquerque was that the magic of New Mexican cuisine is that every single thing on the plate is bland except one thing. And if you eat it bit by bit, it's no good. But if you eat it all together, it works. Mm-hmm. Because you guys mentioned the 52 minutes of dudes walking into other dudes and saying things like, I would have thought this was a meeting I would have been invited to. Clearly you're here now. Thank you. I mean, I thought for a while that this show was dubbed because it had been in another language. That was the level of dialogue we're working
on. And the thing is that, Andy, I mildly disagree with you, but I take your point. It's not like they saved money on the actors. Papa Asiedu from I May Destroy You is in this. Yeah. Michelle Fairley from Game of Thrones is in this. Yep. Cole Meany is in this for a cup of coffee.
What Joe a flex Cole by Cole Meany.
From Peaky Blinders is the star of the show.
Mark Lewis Jones calling down the thunder again into his voice, screaming an inch from people's faces.
Salador San from Game of Thrones finally getting some burn that he was denied in Westeros. Yeah, no, absolutely. And I also want to say, so that I'm just not the negative Nancy of this podcast, once my dude Elliot, by the way, who's Elliot? Maybe you guys can help me out with that one. When he walks into the bar, I was like, oh, okay, great. Great. It's the part in Pleasantville when they're back in color. And like that, I am a human. I respond to this. This was great.
Andy, did that last as long as the time between Elliot walking into the bar and him glassing a guy? Or was there more?
Well, here's the thing. You know me. You glass one guy, you've glassed them all.
Sure.
But when you specifically double glass them, or you glass them once and then curb them.
Right.
That is, you know, that's bringing something new to the table or to the top of the bar. And so I appreciate that.
See, that's how I felt when the show started, because it starts with the one guy, they shoot it from his point of view and he's dangling upside down. And you already know this is like a gangster show. And okay, cool. I've seen, like, you know immediately, oh, they're hanging a guy off the side of a building right now. That's what's happening. And so that's going on. And I was like, all right, cool. I know what the temperature of this show is.
It's hot.
And then Sean Wallace, the Sean Wallace character, I believe who it is.
Yeah.
Yes.
Pours gasoline on him and then sets him on fire as he's dangling upside down.
Carried the gasoline to the top of the building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like a 5-gallon container, right? He was committed to this bit. But again, I had not seen that before in a movie, because now you're realizing, oh, they're going to set him on fire. We're going to watch the rope eventually snap. He's going to fall to his death, but it's going to hurt for every single possible second.
Sure.
Was just like, oh, this is cool. It wasn't, the rest of the show wasn't boring to me. It was like fun to watch, like in a very snatched
Chris,
sort of way.
You've been to London more recently, I believe, than the rest of us. Is the 11 p.m. hour burning of the snitch still in practice? Is that something that, can you see it from all the parts of Piccadilly?
They're closing pubs at 10 now. So
let me just say, have it earlier before it gets dark?
Let me just say, by the time you get to the fourth episode,
you're changed.
The burning of the snitch has then evolved into a more of a grilling, a roasting of a snitch.
Huh.
And that brings me to a point that I'd like to raise, which is that, man, Gareth Evans, one, knows how to absolutely slap you in the face with an action scene, and then he knows how to come back with the next scenes and be like, and here's how we elevate that from the previous iteration, which was already on 11. I mean, it just, the levels that this goes to in terms of violence as you go into it are, I've seen a lot of action movies and I love them.
Yeah.
Shocking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Shock.
Freaking shocking.
Jason, right now, for people, because we're seeing this on Zoom, but Jason looks like a guy who went to a lot of Dead shows, but then he went to Altamont. And he's like,
that's right.
Man, that was tough.
I've seen the way that I've seen the demon that lurks in us all. I'll also say that, like, the first episode, frankly, for me, was like a mess. In terms of the story, I was just like, where are we?
Who are these guys?
I have no idea what's going on in the show.
That's my guy.
Why is Elliot doing the things he's doing and for who? And then why is Sean mad at Elliot for helping him? That gets resolved by midway through the second episode. Mm-hmm. But the first episode is basically a long run up to what is essentially an unbelievable 5 to 6 minute action sequence.
And it's worth mentioning that the first two episodes are considered the two parts of the first episode. So they split them up, but you would say that this is considered the first two parts of the first episode. I should also say that while people are probably like, I cannot believe this collection of minds are spending this amount of time talking about dudes getting annihilated in pub fights, this is a hugely popular show in England. This was actually like a huge hit. So I'm very curious to see whether it translates over here. To your point, Andy, about the non-action scenes and whether or not I found it, you know, whether or not it sang for me. Jason's right. It's very confusing in the beginning, and it takes a while to kind of figure out, was this guy adopted? What's the deal with the family here? But I will say, for me, and I think I bet these other guys agree, in the same way that my mom will just watch 43 episodes of SVU in a row, or the same way I know people who are just like, I will watch any episode of House or any episode of Grey's or any episode of ER, no matter how many times I've seen it, because I like medical procedurals. I will just watch warring factions of gangster families mildly kind of negotiate until they beat the shit out of each other in almost any context. And at almost any level of writing, like I will watch Den of Thieves or I will watch Heat. And while I recognize that Heat is way better than Den of Thieves, I don't really make that big distinction because I'm like, okay, this is just pleasant to me. It's just like, I really, really enjoy the Mayu.
So can I take you guys' temperature on a couple things? Because you speak this language, you're familiar with this, you feel comfortable in this world. You may or may not have glassed some people in your time. I don't know. And I don't judge. I judge a little. Some hypotheticals I want to throw at you guys. You just tell me if this is good or bad. Hypothetical number one, you're low level something in a criminal organization, and you would like to get your foot in the door a little bit more. Do you work your way up slow and steady? You drive for somebody for a while and maybe you run a corner or whatever. Or do you see when all the top minds are gathered poring over cell phone footage and just be like, oi, I know that guy. Like,
oi.
That's really putting yourself on the line. You know what I mean? Like, Elliot's really—he's really looking for a come up. Like, is that kind of
go-getter
right
attitude that really gets rewarded, though?
He's already been undercover for 2 years in this role.
Right. So that's the thing. And now he's on the doorstep.
As what?
He's on the cusp.
He's been working for that guy in the bar.
The guy who won.
And now
all of a sudden
he's knocking on the door.
Oh yeah.
With this a chance to get next to.
Okay.
The next guy who's coming up into the organization.
Well, his introduction into the show, or his like taking over the storyline, is when the show becomes good or interesting, because that's when you figure out, oh, okay, this is like, he's our point into this. He's going to walk us through all this. We're going to rise up with him, and then we get to see him do all of this cool
and,
shit.
And So Page Riso is the actor, and one of the great things about being an English actor is you can work your whole life to get into the Royal Shakespeare Company, and then you get a call from Gareth Evans, and it's like, can you also stab someone in the throat? And
he's Papa Essiedu, who is amazing, and he's incredible, and I made the story he played Kwame. Yeah.
Love that actor.
He played Hamlet recently for the RSC.
It's fucking unbelievable.
And I just watched this video where he's like, oh, yes, Hamlet was a wonderful thing to do. And then he is like Alex in Gangs of London, who's just like, I'm strapping up because you never know. The best part about this show to me is what an indictment it is on London policing. Because
oh my god,
these guys are not obscuring what they are doing at all.
They're doing it out in the street.
Not at all.
They're doing it in the street.
Not 1%.
I have to say that the reason why I would recommend this show without reservation to anyone living in America in 2020 is it will cure you of your desire to travel. Like, we are all stuck in our homes and sitting here dreaming of international travel. You know, playgrounds are still closed here, and yet, if you go to London, a city that I thought of as a pretty happening place, and you take your children to a playground, they may see someone's ankle get snapped. And not from falling off a hobby horse.
I'm not sure what the rules are for undercover work in Metro London, in the UK in general.
Yeah.
But it's great that Elliot gets to maim, probably kill, or at least paralyze seven dudes in the first episode. And
it's eight dudes. Not,
it doesn't even get a, you got to fill out some paperwork from his handler. Like, that's just in the course of events. It, that's
clean
just what
your
happens.
Clean the blood off of your hands and keep it moving. That's all you got to do.
He is a violent super spreader. He kills all eight people who know each other.
Greenwald hasn't even seen the second episode where Elliot fights a dude in his tidy whiteys with a butcher knife.
You didn't see the second one? Oh, man.
And Elliot just has a mattress. And that's the only thing that Elliot can fight. Is that guy's Albanian?
A butcher's blade versus a mattress.
There's a whole other thing with Elliot where he just... And then he meets his boss, and his boss is like, you're in too deep.
No,
when your season too deep.
That was my favorite line in the episodes that we've seen so far is when the boss's kid is like asking him, "Oh, how did you do this? You did all of this. How many guys was like six guys?" And he corrects him and he says, "Oh, it was eight, but I had a dart." So I fucking love Elliot already. So already
the butcher knife scene is very interesting. Man, Gareth Edwards has an almost anatomical eye for these fight scenes. It reminds me of Gangs of New York. Remember when Bill is like, here it's a kill, here it's a kill, here you bleed out. It's that the fight scene with the butcher knife, you get a front row seat at various arteries and tendons getting severed.
Oof.
And then the fight goes on for another 3 minutes.
Keeps happening.
Yeah.
Is there
I sold it to you, Andy.
I am interested in butchery. You know, I feel like it's important to be able to prepare food for my family. So animals are animals.
I greatly enjoy when a director does a trick. Gareth Evans does this really well, but the Russo brothers also do it. They did it in Extraction anyway, where they will use a part of the room as a weapon, opening to a door, and they just throw somebody halfway into it and it spins their body around or flips them. Like they do that during the butcher fight when they wrap up Elliot's head in the jacket and then he flips him over his shoulder into that block. That sort of shit is just so much fun to watch because every single time you're just like, it just looks like it hurts so much. Even it had to have hurt the stunt people to do this thing. And I just appreciate it.
I mean, there's certain things that in the bar fight towards the end of the bar fight where he's pulling, a guy is trying to escape from him. He pushes a picnic table over to a wall and he leaps over the wall. And then there's another guy who's going over a railing and he grabs the guy. Elliot grabs the guy around the collar.
Just
and then
fucking
just
yanks him.
Whips him down so that his, in one shot, so that his head just wallops off like a metal trash bin. I do not know how they do this without guys walking out of there with multiple contusions.
Andy does it in a Tom Ford pea coat.
I know
what I mean?
Very well dressed guys.
Respect. I'll say this, regardless of my taste or distaste for violence, he is a director like none other, because the way that he uses all of the space and makes the entire world. I mean, you guys could probably speak to the video game logic of it a little better than I could, but everything, even like the non-player characters, are alive and active in the background, right? And you watch any other director, particularly in television, where you're like, look, I'm going to put three things here and a flower on the table, and the camera's going to be here. Partly because we don't have enough time to animate the entire background and have 100 extras moving from the moment we say go, but also lack of imagination at times, right? And so to see space used like that is really radical.
It's space and it's speed, too. Like, I think that there is a hyper-realism to it that almost divorces it from, for me at least, from being like stomach churning. Like it is definitely like pretty vivid to watch. But to me, it's almost like watching athletes. Like, and to sort of not be able to imagine how they're even pulling some of these stunts off, and knowing like his legacy of the Raid movies, you're just kind of like, no one operates on this level in terms of being able to orchestrate these kinds of physical tableaus. It's not for everybody. I can't imagine that everybody. If you were like watching the first 50 minutes of this show and you were like, it's pretty good. I'm into it. I want to find out what's going on with Sean and Alex and Elliot. And then that happened. You'd have to have a pretty strong stomach to take it.
I have another question, just procedural question, if you don't mind. So I'll put it to Shay first. But like, let's say, Shay, this isn't your real life. You're a wonderful guy, family guy. But let's say that you were part of the underworld of San Antonio. And there were maybe like 8 families, let's say, who met in dark rooms to talk about what goes on at the docks.
Yeah.
But let's say, and someone got picked off, like the head got knocked off, the king. Someone came at the king and they didn't miss, much like the plot of Gangs in New York. But let's say you're the king's best friend and literally no one suspects you of anything and you are eulogizing him at the funeral. How thick would you lay it on?
Yeah.
Because my guy literally stands up and says, when I lost my wife, the only thing left for me and my family was this man, and I dedicate every fiber of my being and every breath I take going forward to you. And I got to say, that's when the suspicion kicked in.
This is how I know that you and I watch TV shows different, because I watched that scene and I was like, that's really touching. He really cared. He really cared about it. I did not suspect him at all until you started talking, and now I think you might be right.
And I'm not spoiling anything, but I'm like, that's... I've only seen one episode, but there's some stuff like that.
I guess there's some things like that, but we're just watching it differently. You know, one of my favorite things that happens in a show or a movie is when you just, like, and this is, will like backdoor into your point, is when you just have no idea what's about to happen. Like you can't guess anymore. Jordan Peele is like a director like that, where you watch Get Out and you just, at a certain point, you just have to give up at guessing at what is going on and just wait to be shown. And that's how I feel about Gareth Evans when he's doing a fight scene. Like any other fight scene, I feel like if I can see a still shot of it, I'm like, oh, okay, this is probably going to happen in this way. If you watch Mile 22 and they do the hospital fight scene, you're like, oh, they're probably going to bust through that window and this is going to happen, that's going to happen. But when Gareth Evans gets his hands on a scene, you just have to give yourself up to it entirely, and it becomes so much fun. Like Chris was saying, it doesn't feel like you're watching something especially gruesome. It feels to me like art almost, like fucking a ballet,
like,
a beautiful
like dance.
Ballet. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Great.
Yeah, and Jay, like I would separate what happens in Gangs from another show that, you know, a bunch of people on this call all love, which is 000, where like the violence in 000 I think hits in a different way, essentially because it's like, it's baked into the story and it's telling you about character. I think you learn a lot about the Harold Torres character in 000 based on like what he's willing to do in that show. And the same thing goes for the Andrea Riseborough character in terms of what she's willing to sanction. In this show so far, like it's this weird Frankenstein of pretty straightforward crime family drama.
Right.
Attached to this, like, then this almost like, it almost becomes more psychedelic because it feels like it's stapled onto this other show. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think that's the only bummer I had, is I think the single most interesting thing for me as a not coming into this for Gareth Evans, but coming into it because Chris told me you two guys were coming on the podcast to talk about it, that I was making fun of the eulogy, but when the guy stands up there and he's just like, there was a time in London where there were signs that said no blacks and no Irish. And so we, as immigrants, join forces. Mm-hmm. And like, that's awesome. That's fascinating. That's interesting. That's like a vision, a version of London that, you know, is undertold, at least in the stuff that makes it over to this country. So I wish that it was interested in saying more about that, when I do think, as Chris is saying, it's really interested in setting up opportunities for balletic death.
What do you think, Jay?
Yeah. I agree with that. I mean, back to Shay's point of not knowing what's going to happen. That's, you know, I think that's a thing that audiences love, and I absolutely am thrilled by when I see particularly an action scene that surprises me after all the action movies I've seen. And for television, it's like the two other scenes that made me feel the way Gangs has so far in 3.5 episodes have been, Who Goes There? First season of True Detective, mm-hmm. where the
tracking
me,
shot.
Yeah. The tracking shot that just like blew me out of my living room. And the season 3 jailbreak fight in Daredevil on Netflix that is another tracking shot that is like incredible. A lot of the kind of Gareth Evans-y touches where a lot of chaos happening in the background. Guys coming out of the blind side to attack the main character. A lot of first person kind of perspective. But that the entire season was kind of a bore and went on too long. Every fight scene so far in Gangs of London through 3 episodes has been like, it almost levels up like a video game levels mm-hmm. up, where it's like, you know, the first bar fight is here's your hero. The second fight in episode 2 is here's your first boss. And then the bosses just keep getting bossier. And so in that sense, I really can't even imagine where they're going to go by episode 5, 6, 7, 8, truly mind bending stuff. And to your point, Chris, yeah, it is. It's going to be hard to watch, I think, for people who aren't, fans of violent movies. That said, it's not as dire as like 000, where you feel like you're staring into the dark soul inside, government and
globalism,
the human spirit. Yeah, like I came away from every episode of 000 on the one hand being like, holy shit, and on the other hand being like, we are doomed like as a race of people. Gangs of London, I'm just like, yeah, fire up the next one. Let's go. I want to see it.
Shay, do you think that one of the things that I know that you guys talk about a lot, you and Jason, is the way in which action movies almost act like the same way like in classic rock or in rap, where like something will come along and deeply influence everything that comes after it. And people just start stealing little parts of it. Whether, you know, you see, I guess Wick comes after Raid, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And so Wick clearly like saw Raid and saw you can kind of do all this stuff in real time, like in these wide shots with these incredible stuntmen, if you have this harmony between the stunt department and the camera department and the director. And then you see also, I think that shows up then in Atomic Blonde and like these other things. Yeah. What do you think that like this is pushed to such an extremity that it's hard to imagine something that you see in Gangs of London showing up in like more quote unquote mainstream stuff?
I think the only way that this is going to be hard to pull off is if you have somebody who's trying to do it on television. And like, if you have the space to do it in a movie, that makes sense. Like all of the like comps that I have in my head while I was watching the bar fight scene or the butcher blade scene, it was no TV show stuff. That maybe the Daredevil one that Jason mentioned, but it was all like other stuff that I had seen in movies. Like the apartment fight scene in Extraction. We're talking about the Russo brothers. Like I was going to stuff like that. Big budget. They have the time. They have the energy. They have the space. I don't know that you will have other people trying to do this on TV. Maybe something like Netflix or Hulu or whatever. I hope so. I fucking really hope so. But it just seems like one of those situations where you have to have the exact right person or people working on a thing. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I would love to see more of it. I think that, you know, to back to the idea of this being like 3% less kinetic than the Raid movies, I think that a lot of it is going to depend on choosing the right actors who have that kind of physicality to pull this off. The, you know, there's the way a Gareth Evans style fight scene is shot is you can't really hide a stuntman in it. It's got to be the actor in the center of the action. If they could figure out a way to do this more, I think that this kind of thing is out there. There's a series called High and Low the Worst out of Japan, which is this weird like spin-off of this like boy band action series, and they have fight scenes that are like, imagine 100 members of different boy bands fighting in the street, and it looks like Gareth Evans meets Avengers Endgame. There's a lot of these styles of action movies right now are kind of coalescing in different areas of cinema. And so I think that it could happen. And I think the synergy that could come out of it is hopefully something we've never seen before. Certainly
you will see stuff like this in Marvel movies within the next 5 years, like a much more vanilla version of it. But I think you did even in like the elevator fight in Captain America. You know what I mean? Like, and it's really interesting because when you and me, and when we were all growing up, and Andy's having Wi-Fi problems, so he's not on the call. He's not just taking a vow of silence. but when we were growing up, the thing with these action movies was that they were almost like urban legends. Like you would get a tape of a John Woo movie at like the cool video store, and like the guy behind the counter would be like, "Oh man, you're about to check out the real shit." Mm-hmm. And then that would like change your life. And then you would start to see it in a Quentin Tarantino movie or whatever. And then John Woo would come to America and do Mission Impossible and Broken Arrow and stuff. But initially, like this wasn't like a show comes on in London featuring a guy who's been making these movies in Asia directing, and then we get to see it in the States almost immediately. Like that's completely new now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That is kind of an example of the effect of this globalized culture that we have, that where, you know, there's a Twitter account that I just slacked you with a clip from the movie I just was talking about called One Perfect Headshot at Head Exposure. And it's literally just, whoever this person is just posts action movie clips from Asian action movies and action movies, world action cinema. And the fact that people can have access to that kind of thing and hear about and see movies, clips from movies that they just would never have heard of before, I think is one of the best things about being alive in 2020.
There's only like five. Only like five good things.
the most direct line example of this happening, and Jason and I have talked about this a bunch, is in John Wick 3 when they bring in the two guys from the raid.
Yeah.
And they're like, they're very clearly paying homage to that series because the raid is like basically what John Wick is, but just with slightly better fighting. But they bring those two guys in and they write it very intentionally where they have those two guys beat up John Wick. Just straight up, they beat him up. They could have killed him right here if they wanted to.
Yeah.
But then they back away and they're like, you know, it's great to fight you, whatever. And then the movie continues and then eventually John Wick wins. But that sort of stuff is like happening over a shorter and shorter amount of time now. Like you can see it much
instantaneously.
Quicker.
Yeah, like guys are seeing these things and then they're immediately employing them into their movies.
Exactly.
I will say too, like in a weird way, it's kind of this style, the frenetic style, lots of people fighting on screen, is almost a return to like an old Hollywood tradition, like the old cowboy saloon barroom brawl where dudes were like hanging off the chandeliers and getting thrown through the windows. It's just morphed out into the rest of the world and come back to us in this extremely amplified version.
Mm-hmm.
Andy's back. Before we let you guys go, I just wanted to ask you guys if you've been watching anything else on TV recently that you wanted to talk about, because, you know, I know that with Connect, you guys have been very immersed in the movies and stuff, but what, anything that's been really like you've been really enjoying over the last couple of weeks or months?
I just binged Teenage Bounty Hunters on Netflix.
Oh, that just got canceled, didn't it?
Listen, I don't know who's... I'll just say this. I've been tweeting about it. I'll just say this. I won't spoil it, but I wanted to say this one thing. Teenage Bounty Hunters has been canceled after one season. Delightful show about two fraternal twins who become bounty hunters. Kadeem Hardison is their like bounty hunter expert who helps them figure out life as bounty hunters, their high school students. There is a cliffhanger that will now never be resolved that will bother me forever unless I find out what this twist means. That's all I'll say. But it's really fun and super fast and really funny. Fun show.
Was that another Netflix production? So is that that has no chance of coming back?
Yes.
It's not just Netflix. It's another Jenji Cohen production.
Oh, no way. Which
suggests perhaps that the new regime is less enamored of her, I guess, than the previous regime.
That's too bad.
There have been two shows that I have been watching. Mm-hmm. Pen 15, yeah. which is fucking awesome. It's just great. It's just so funny and smart. Everybody should definitely watch that one. And then I've been doing a rewatch. You guys will appreciate this. Perfect timing. Sons of Anarchy. I'm back up to season 7. Fucking awesome.
That's great.
Still.
I don't even know awesome if this is still. True. I feel like you're just saying that.
You can go, I swear to God, you can go through my Twitter and see I've been tweeting like each night about Sons of Anarchy.
It's because Chris, because I don't know if you remember, but Shay and I had a deal that when he finished his third complete rewatch, then I would be ready to talk to him about it.
Yeah, yeah.
On the podcast.
Because he wouldn't be like, he was like a training to be a Jedi. And like once he got.
Yeah, I'm not interested in Sons of Anarchy, only fathers. You know what I mean? Like, you have to reach a certain level. Does it just hit different in 2020? How is it treating you?
It still rules. It still rules. It's awesome.
Do you know like all the dialogue and all the moments now? Like, can you just oh, this is where Jax is this?
Yeah. If you give me like a screenshot of an episode, I can tell you what's about to happen or what just happened.
But I do want to bring these guys into the conversation that we've been having, Chris, because one of the things that we've been talking about, which is that in this very fraught moment in American history, like we all have different responses to culture and we're all seeking different mm-hmm. types of relief or entertainment. Mm-hmm. And so, Shay, because you also very famously have a great love of sitcoms mm-hmm. and have written beautifully and wonderfully about Scrubs and The Office, I wondered if you would maybe be doing a rewatch of heartwarming fare like that. But in fact, it seems you are doing the opposite and watching a show where people bite off their own tongues.
It's easier for me to like block everything else out if I'm watching Otto bite his own tongue off so that he doesn't have to talk to the cops. 100%. It just makes me forget about all the
Gangs of London should have tried that.
They probably will. Who knows?
That's true. Jason, what about you? Where are you with this?
With biting off tongues?
Are you pro or con? Why won't you answer the question?
You
have 2 minutes to answer uninterrupted. Tongue biting.
Joe Biden was against the Bin Laden raid. Let me just put that out there. I find myself in this very fraught time in American history kind of gravitating towards more escapist. I've been watching Ted Lasso, which I find delightful.
Ted Lasso rules.
There you go, man.
Ted Lasso is so shockingly good.
Yeah. It's really,
I don't have a home in this world anymore.
I know.
Not even on my own podcast.
You're not in the Gang of London and you're
not... You didn't like Ted Lasso?
You didn't like Ted
Lasso? Gang.
Oh, it's so sweet. It's so sweet.
It's really sweet.
Come on.
This is three guys who've just been talking about pint glasses being smashed into people's faces, heads bouncing off of garbage cans, and ankles getting broken. And then we were all like, oh man, it's so sweet.
I'm going to go to your house. I'm going to tape a construction poster sign above your door that says believe. That way you can slap it every time you walk in.
I just like that you're coming to my house, Shay. That's all I need. That's nice.
All right, guys, thank you so much for coming on and talking about
this
show.
Thank you.
I needed to just share. And Andy, thank you so much for bearing with us. You were a good sport. And
this is my favorite hang, virtual.
This is the
or
hang.
Not.
That's
I love it. Guys, congratulations on the Connect.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Excellent podcast. Everybody should just subscribe.
Great podcast.
We'll talk to you guys soon, sooner than it's taken.
Thank you.
I hope so. All right, y'all.
Bye, guys.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.